This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited to have with me today Dr. Sarah Rich to tell us all about her book titled Mushroom, just out in 2023 from Bloomsbury. This is part of the Object Lesson series that I personally find very cool. And as you can probably guess from the title, this book explores mushrooms in a ton of different ways, historically, in terms of eating them, in terms of where we find them, philosophically, what does it mean for our language and our sense of humanity and our place in the world? So Sarah packs rather a lot into this wonderfully concise, almost hand-sized book. And so Sarah, I'm so pleased to welcome you to the podcast to tell us all about it.
Thank you so much, Miranda. It's so lovely to be here.
Before, however, we dive into all things mushroom, could you maybe start us off introducing yourself a bit and explaining how you came to write this book?
Yeah, so it is kind of an interesting story. So first of all, I'm an assistant professor of honors at Coastal Carolina University, which is a lovely place to be in. I get to teach, some of the best and brightest students at our institution, and they always ask such wonderful questions and get me thinking about things that I never thought about before. So that's probably a big part of how this book sort of got its origin. That combined with, I am also a huge fan of the Object Lessons series and have been. I'm kind of a thing theory enthusiast. And so when the pandemic first started, and I ended up with two spring breaks in a row, which is interesting because in 2020. So that was exactly 3 years ago, like to the day, because it's spring break again. So I ended up with an extra spring break and I thought, well, I've always wanted to write an object lesson, and they were still accepting proposals at the time, not for the Atlantic series of short articles, but for the book series. And so I thought I would just pitch, a project idea on boat wreck. And that's really much more aligned with my expertise as a maritime archaeologist and a person who, essentially studies shipwrecks for a living. I was just finishing up a bigger book project with Amsterdam University Press, and there's also a New Books series podcast about that one. And so I was kind of like looking for a new sort of, thing to think about, and to kind of build on some of the theories that I had started putting together for shipwreck hauntography. And so that's where boat wreck came into play. So I pitched the idea to the series editors, Chris Schauberg and Ian Bogost. And they really liked it. They liked the concept. They liked my writing, but they thought that it was a little bit too close to what I normally write about. And they wanted me to try a different object. So I pitched a few more objects: driftwood, eyeball, and driftwood, eyeball, maybe the something else, and then Mushroom, of course. And Chris Schauberg, you know, one of the series editors, is a forager himself, and is that, you know, he loves to go out in his area in New Orleans, Louisiana, and hunt for morels. And so this had a kind of personal appeal to him. So he picked that one, put it to the advisory board, and got the green light. So I put together a proper, like a full proposal. And I guess that it was at that point that it got the green light from the advisory board. And then, yeah, here we are. So it was really kind of an interesting process, you know, going through this. And I just felt like immediately so honored to like be in this object lessons club, you know, like little me, like if someone thinks my ideas are actually worth this amazing series, you know, being, you know, contributing to this amazing series. So yeah, that's a little bit of the background of the book. I mostly wrote it, I guess in 2021, and then, you know, going through the editing phase and all of that took a bit. And then, yeah, like you said, it just came out like a few weeks ago in January. So it's pretty hot off the presses.
Yeah, very exciting for us. I also am a big fan of the Object Lessons series, so I can imagine what a thrill that was to pitch to them. I must say, I do hope someone does Eyeball at some point. That would be quite cool.
Yeah, I think it would too.
But mushrooms are also pretty cool. As demonstrated simply through reading the table of contents of the book, if one was to start there, because you organize it through a number of different ways. There's kind of a bunch of things happening. So I was wondering if maybe before we get into the chapters themselves, could you tell us a bit about how you organized the book and kind of how you decided on the themes?
Yeah, it's a, I don't know, it's a good question with probably a less than satisfying answer, because initially I was just thinking about like, you know, like all of the disciplinary lenses that I have at my disposal to be able to understand this object as a mushroom. And so I thought about like the sort of religious studies sort of lens, you know, with mystery religions. My PhD is in ancient Near Eastern studies from the University of Leuven in Belgium. And so, you know, a lot of what I have studied in the past has to do with ancient religions of the Middle East and, you know, their sort of extensions into the present day. So I knew I wanted to get into the mysteries a little bit. But then I also started thinking about mushroom as a sort of metaphor. And I drew inspiration from Michael Martyr's Object Lesson Dust in that sense, and where he talks about the different aspects of dusting just as a concept and how it can relay both the accumulation of dust, like in a snowfall or something like that, but also dusting in terms of cleaning. So I started thinking about, you know, about the sort of literary aspect of mushrooms and how it functions in our language. But then I also wanted to think about like the ecology aspect, because a lot of what I do in my work is tree ring analysis. So I do dendrochronology, especially as it pertains to the relationships between forest and shipbuilding, or unfortunately, in many cases, deforestation and shipbuilding. And so I also wanted to take, you know, to spend some time talking about mushrooms from an ecological perspective. So that's the third part on mycology. That's where that one comes into play. And then I started thinking about, you know, like there's all this information now about the therapeutic aspects of mushrooms. And of course, a lot of this is drawing on, you know, on knowledge that has, you know, accumulated over the course of thousands and thousands of years. And so I wanted to consider like the more anthropological aspect of medicine, as well as the physiological part of it. So that sort of, you know, came about with part four. And then part five, of course, because you can't talk about mushrooms without talking about magic mushrooms, right? So the final chapter is on magic. And then each of these sections is composed of two smaller sections. And then each of the sections is also interspersed with the name of a season. And like, that's devoted to one mushroom that happens to appear in that particular season, and give some instructions on how to find that mushroom and then what to do with it when you do. So yeah, it's a kind of unusual structure. And I guess as far as the structure itself is concerned, I was also kind of inspired from another object lessons book on ocean by Steve Mentz, where he makes this very deliberate kind of conscious choice about the structure of the volume and thinking about the dualities of ocean. And so for each point, there's a sort of counterpoint. So I really liked that sort of deliberate aspect of his structure, and wanted to incorporate something similar, but that would be specific to my object, being mushroom. And there's more to say about that, but I think we'll get there maybe later on.
Well, we're definitely going to get into a lot of the themes that you mentioned. And I think the interweaving almost of the different ways the reader is engaged was really fascinating, kind of, because it would be one thing to just go, okay, well, there's a chapter on this, a chapter on that. But the fact that there's the interludes and the different ways of thinking about it gave a whole extra layer to it. And in some sense, in some instances, you directly address the reader. So I was wondering, kind of, how do you want readers to engage with the book?
So this book became very personal very quickly, and I did not expect it to really take on that that level of, I don't know, sort of like personal life history exposure, confessional kind of stuff. And so before we get into the first part on mystery, there's a preamble. So all of these sections are sort of bookended with a preamble and, of course, a postamble. And, you know, the idea is that we're foraging throughout this book. And so because I refer to like personal anecdotes frequently, and my own history of foraging, not just in a literal sense, but maybe in a more figurative sense as well. It seemed kind of appropriate that, like, if I'm inviting the reader into like this level of intimacy with my life, then I should probably also sort of reciprocate, right? And so for every pronoun, a personal pronoun, you know, the first person pronoun, there is a second person pronoun too. And so you're right that, like, in a couple of different places, I sort of address the reader more directly and invite the reader to imagine certain things or to read certain sections out loud and to not skip the Latin parts and things like that. So I really do, like, I want this book to be as interactive as it is intimate. For the reader to kind of walk away with maybe a new sense of one's place in the ecosystem.
With that lovely sort of framing, I suppose, and context, understanding sort of what the book looks like, what you're putting into it and bringing to it, let's turn to mushrooms themselves, by themselves, maybe. And there's kind of maybe it sounds like a silly question to start, but it's really interesting. I sort of saw it on the page and was like, okay, so what? And then kept reading and was like, oh, okay, hang on. There's a lot of what here. And this is essentially the simple idea of, how do we refer to mushrooms? It? They?
All right. So yeah, this is a kind of tricky question.
How can we think about this?
Yeah. It is a deceptively simple question. I kept thinking about like those little maxims, you know, that you hear a lot, like in the guidebooks, and just like these little rules of thumb, you know, that are passed down from one generation of forager to the next. And so, you know, these little maxims like little and brown, leave them in the ground, or, you know, when in doubt, throw it out, or when in doubt, don't pluck it out, things like that. But that pronoun of it seems so dismissive. I feel sort of hesitant to sort of use such a dismissive pronoun, or at least to write about it. Maybe in colloquial speech, you know, it's just so ingrained that we can't really, you know, it's much more difficult to get away from it. But at least when you're writing and you have the, you know, the option of editing your work and you know, changing your views, like in midstream even, it seemed like a good opportunity to kind of address like how, you know, how sort of, you know, like aware and alive mushrooms are by trying to incorporate a different conception. And so I stumbled across, I don't even remember how at this point, but at some point I stumbled across an article in Orion, which is an English language magazine. It's brilliant. It's all about, you know, sort of interactions of nature and culture. Beautiful writing, constantly, consistently represented in that book. And so one of the articles in Orion from a couple of years ago was written by Potawatomi botanist and poet Robin Wall Kimmerer. And this article that she wrote sort of appeared again later on in her now very famous collection of essays that are compiled in the book Braiding Sweetgrass, which I highly recommend. And she is, you know, drawing from like, you know, her experience as a Native woman, but it's not just about like, you know, like indigenous views on botany or Potawatomi specific views on botany, but also just about like what it is to like be a woman and experience, you know, the world and like plants and like her love of plants. And of course that extends into fungi for this thinker, as it has for many, many other thinkers as well. So she offers in this Orion essay the Potawatomi word to describe a sort of like living being of an animate world. And that word is ki, K-I. And so it makes for a kind of interesting comparison with some other concepts that are more in the Western tradition, including the Germanic word kin. Which is, you know, referring to sort of like familial relations, but it doesn't necessarily have to be confined to people that you are a blood relative to. And so that seems really promising. And then there's also, and again, kind of drawing from my background in ancient Near Eastern studies, a Sumerian signifier, which is also ki, K-I, which just means like it refers to, it sort of modifies a noun and means that it's of the earth, of the land, of the place. In fact, it's usually translated land. So this also seems kind of like, you know, really interesting and thinking about like, you know, humanity's first written language used that exact same pairing of letters, K and I, to signify something that's, you know, comparable in the Potawatomi language. So I tried to kind of like try this out, you know, in at least in the first chapter, and like, you know, sort of use some wordplay to try to incorporate this pronoun ki into discussions of mushrooms. So like, you know, if you were to substitute ki for it, then all of a sudden the phrase becomes, you know, when in doubt, don't pluck ki out. And so anyway, that's, you know, that's kind of like, you know, something that I wanted to sort of experiment with. And again, I just think it's a beautiful concept to, you know, to recognize things that we often understand as inanimate, as inert, as actually being very lively and being like a part of this bigger earth system that is in itself lively and animated.
Speaking of how we understand things and how we understand lively, animated life things, I was really intrigued in one of the more historical aspects of the book when you look at how, I guess medieval would be the correct time period, scientists, I hesitate to use that term, but people who were trying to figure out what was happening in nature, how they were trying to think about the world. And of course, we know this most frequently, I think, when we think of sort of Christian theology of the hierarchy of there's God, then there's Jesus, then there's these angels, and they're better than those angels, and all that sort of thing. And the kind of very complicated diagrams that go all the way down into the multiple circles and rings of hell. And this was quite clearly a big thing for them for a long time, to categorize all the things in these ranking systems. And yet you point out that mushrooms and fungi, despite definitely being things that they would have encountered, don't tend to show up in these lists and rankings. Why not?
Yeah, it is very interesting. And I think this goes back to an Aristotelian understanding of the ordered world. And so even though, like, you know, we see this sort of start to crystallize with medieval scientists and philosophers and theologians as well, they're really drawing on a more ancient classical tradition even. So, you know, part of the problem is that mushrooms were sort of lumped in with plants and not actually considered a separate branch of organisms until like the 70s, which is just crazy, you know, to think that, like, you know, for all this time, You know, and even Aristotle himself said, you know, I'm pretty sure that fungi are a sort of type of plant, but somebody should probably look into this a little bit further. And then no one bothered to for like literally thousands of years. It's so crazy. But when we do see mushrooms start to appear as sort of separate-ish from other plants, they are ranked even lower, you know, in this hierarchy of life forms than plants themselves. And, you know, you just have to sort of wonder why. And that question itself was a huge guiding force, you know, in the writing of this book, especially in the early chapters, but it's referenced later on in the book as well, where, you know, it's like, why would fungi be placed like right above inanimate objects like tea kettles and, you know, skeleton keys and cups and things like that? It is really kind of strange how they get sort of siphoned out. And it seems like with so many things, once you start to separate and siphon one thing out from another, then it becomes far too easy to place it into some pre-existing concept of a hierarchical order.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
If Aristotle tells you to do something, surely you would do it, right?
One would think.
One would think. Staying in the historical part of the book for a bit, what do you think links, as you've done in the book, mushrooms with big historical things that we might not usually think mushrooms have any relation to, such as the Crusades or the Renaissance?
Yeah, this is a really big question. And of course, like, I don't necessarily see any sort of like direct causal link between these big historical events and mushrooms, other than, you know, when we start to, this is such a hard question to ask, or it's a hard question to answer. It's the kind of like the system of othering that the Crusades sort of brought on. If we see the Renaissance as a continuation of the Crusades, right? And that the Crusades sort of like really started to draw very strict distinctions between communities that had been living together, you know, more or less happily, you know, for hundreds of years, and really started to kind of draw distinctions between these things. Once again, siphoning out one thing from another, in this case, religious practice. And so with that kind of siphoning out, we see this in the visual art of the Renaissance in particular. We see strange things start to happen, such as kind of loose affiliations between Jewry, between Judaism, and mushrooms and witchery. So all of these things sort of kind of get wrapped up into the same kind of demonizing concepts of you know, infidel religious practices and demonic practices, and somehow mushrooms kind of get wrapped up in that. And we see it kind of time and time again in the visual culture of the Renaissance and even later, where mushrooms are again kind of associated with other Abrahamic religions besides Christianity, as well as with witchcraft.
So obviously I have to ask you about witchcraft. So thank you for giving me the perfect linking between the questions, because mushrooms are, of course, heavily linked with witchery, witchcraft, and sort of wrapped up in that, of course, is, you know, fears of female sexuality and things like that. So why exactly how did mushrooms come to have this association?
Well, I think that first of all, it's a kind of chicken or egg sort of question. And to be frank with you, I don't exactly know the origins of how exactly these associations came to be. Almost like a, you know, metaphorical stand-in for the other. But we do know from, like, our, you know, sort of Romance languages and Germanic languages that fairy circles are often referred to as witch rings. And there seems to be something, and I think it's also like the phallic shape of mushrooms, of many mushrooms themselves, that sort of lend themselves to this idea of, like, of women worshiping the devil, dancing around in circles, and then mushrooms, these, you know, these phallic shaped appearances sort of, you know, come up overnight in this, you know, seemingly, diabolical way. And so, but again, like, I don't know what actually caused. It's hard to kind of say what a causal link is here, but, at any rate, there is a pretty clear association between these things. I'm just hesitant to say, you know, what the causal relationship would be.
No, of course, it's more sort of how do you think they relate to each other, which I think you've kind of helpfully explained with those examples, the diabolicalness, the fact that it looks like male sex organs. I can see how those associations relate.
Yeah, and there are some other interesting things too. Like, there are several mushrooms, like, across Eurasia that have this reputation for being aphrodisiacs. And so again, some of them also, like, look very, very phallic, like very phallic. You have this kind of very clear relationship between this phallic looking object and female sexuality, and which, you know, should be the same as, you know, just like healthy sex life in general, right? But for some reason, you know, women are sort of left out of those pleasures in a lot of history. So the idea of women's sexuality as being something dangerous is not exclusive to, you know, to European history at all. But there does seem to be, again, another one of those little weird connections between the danger of mushrooms and ingesting the wrong one, or, you know, a dangerous lookalike, and female sexuality. I also wonder if the relationship between mushrooms and femaleness doesn't have to do with the fact that we have historically and prehistorically been charged with a lot of the foraging responsibilities to our communities.
Yep, all those things together make rather a lot of sense. So thank you for taking us through that thinking. But I want to move from the past to potentially the future, because one of the other things you talk about in the book is potentially ways in which mushrooms might be relevant to this current problem we're facing of the survival of the planet.
Yeah, and I mean, just to be clear, I mean, I have no doubt at all in my mind that planet Earth will be just fine. Like, human activity is not going to bring an apocalypse onto the planet as a whole, but certainly is bringing something like an apocalypse into ecosystems and biodiversity, and the health of the planet, I think, is maybe more at stake than its survivability. But yeah, there's been a huge amount of information about this, and a lot of traction being gained by certain people of an evangelical strain, such as Paul Stamets and the like, who have been, you know, doing a lot of research into the potentials of mushrooms to be able to break down a lot of our toxic waste, including things like cigarette butts. So they can, you know, like metabolize things that, you know, seemingly should not be metabolized, but also things like nuclear waste. And of course, Anna Singh Loewenhaupt's famous book, The Mushroom and the End of the World, also discusses this too. Like, you know, the idea of mushrooms being able to kind of clean up after human error. And so, yeah, this is a kind of hot topic right now. And I share some opinions in the book that probably are not compatible with opinions that a lot of other people have about this hot topic. I don't know if you want me to elaborate on that.
Yeah, why not?
All right. So I have a real hesitance with this idea of outsourcing the responsibility for cleaning up our own messes. So one of my students just brought to my attention that apparently trees are now being bioengineered to absorb more carbon dioxide. And, you know, we have long been, you know, expecting bacteria and mushrooms, fungi more generally, to do the same thing for us. And I think that is really just irresponsible and runs the danger of sort of adding to our problems. I also have a problem with this in terms of expecting, there's a kind of like a little bit of a savior complex, I think, going on here as well, where there is something kind of messianic, where we expect, we can sort of like live our lives, our day-to-day lives, and keep doing exactly the same things that we are doing with the hope or even the faith, maybe, that some sort of divine interlocutor will save us from ourselves. And I worry that you know, people in the sort of Paul Stamets strain of thought run into kind of a similar problem where they're saying, okay, well, we can just continue sort of doing the same things that we're doing more or less. We just have to train mushrooms to clean up our mess. And so it sort of brings the divine down into the earthly realm, which on, you know, at a sort of surface level would seem like maybe a positive, maybe a good thing. Maybe we, you know, that is a way of taking responsibility. But it's the problem of like being able to have your cake and eat it too, you know, where we can just like carry on doing the exact same things that we have been doing, you know, like to prioritize human flourishing above everything else. And just, you know, again, kind of like expect other organisms to do our dirty work for us. And lacking in responsibility, also just straight up rude. It's just rude.
Well, let's try to not be rude when we move our discussion over to obviously magic, because you mentioned it at the beginning. It's in the book. We have to talk about it. You have some very interesting terms in the book that I'd love you to tell us about, specifically mycotheology and mushroom metaphysics.
All right. So this is another kind of difficult question to answer, but I basically use these terms synonymously. So I think of mushroom metaphysics as sort of like a broad, maybe a slightly broader umbrella category, and mycotheology sort of fits within that. I think that, you know, as far as mushroom metaphysics is concerned, you may have noticed that there's an alliteration going on here with all of the yes. the sections of the book, starting with the letter M. Mushroom metaphysics is in that same vein, but it's basically drawing from this idea of the entheogen, which is something that people have been writing about, like especially anthropologists and historians of religion have been writing about for decades. And it's this idea of like basically where magic mushrooms bring one closer to God. And so and theogen is anything that sort of brings about an experience with the divine. And so they're usually referring to mushrooms like psilocybin, but also the Amanita muscaria, and, you know, in some cases also what is the word I'm looking for? Like LSD and ergot. Ergot is what I was looking for. So any of these kind of substances, and even in some cases, people talk about, alcoholic beverages as this is like, you know, being able to initiate this contact with the divine. So I want to start with this idea of entheogen and sort of expand it to not just the mind-altering fungi, not just the fungi that we normally think about as being magic, but also like all of them. And thinking about like just the relationship that these organisms have with their ecosystem as being in many cases parasitic, in many cases mutualistic, having like these very complex partnerships. And, you know, just thinking about, I guess, like moving or like relocating our ideas of the divine back to something more chthonic, something more earthbound. So I guess I'll stop there and then I can let you ask a follow-up question if you'd like, if I need to explain that better.
No, I think that was a good explanation and makes sense to kind of broaden out this scope and is very much in keeping with, I think, what a lot of the book is trying to do, to make us think about this seemingly ordinary thing in very different ways, kind of in particular ways, and also linking them together. And to me, this very much links to how you end the book, because it doesn't have a super traditional ending. I was very intrigued by the ending. So I was wondering if you could, maybe without giving too much away, tell us how you ended the book, why you did that, and how people have responded.
All right. So, a lot of the book's sort of overall project, and I think this goes back to the previous question that you were asking as well about the relationship between mycotheology and mushroom metaphysics, is to kind of disrupt this or even invert, you know, the scala naturae or the hierarchy of organisms, the great chain of being and so forth. And so I wanted to try to like flip that and place mushrooms sort of like on equal footing with humans and all other, earthly forms of existence here. And so the ending of the book in a way kind of goes back to the beginning. And so there's a sort of circularity, and there's a theme of circularity that also runs throughout the book as well. And so the ending of the book tries to sort of, again, kind of emphasize the structure, because I realized at some point that not only did this structure have like a sort of rhythm to it, but that rhythm also sort of resembled walking. And so if you remember, I mentioned the very beginning of the book, there is a preamble. And there's a sort of a little play on words there about ambulation, right? Which is what one has to do in order to forage in most cases. And so I wanted to sort of point out to the reader, you know, that they've been sort of like walking, you know, step by step, two at a time, because we are bipedal, like through this sort of foraging venture and like through numerous seasons and various cycles. And so I want the object of the book to sort of represent its subject in as many ways as I could. And so then it raised the question of like, well, okay, so you've got this sort of like rhythmic walking as well as like the circular seasonality. But then what about the sort of weirdness of mushrooms, like the sort of like the unpredictable aspect of mushrooms where, you know, like they appear for no reason. They seem to disappear for no reason. They often can't even be identified with scientific certainty. And so I realized also that throughout this entire book, I really hadn't made any references to Alice in Wonderland, which seemed like a really missed opportunity. So I invited the reader to sort of play a game, because I'm a big fan of anagrams. And so the idea is, involves the reader. And again, I don't want to tell too much, but the reader has to actually go back through the book and search for little hidden clues, and then put those clues together in order to solve a puzzle. So it ends with a game.
And how have people reacted to that?
I don't know. You're the first person I've talked to who's actually asked me about it.
Did the editors say anything or any eyebrows raised?
I think the editor liked it. Chris Schauber liked it. But because the book is so new, I haven't really had a lot of contact with other readers. Mm. So my husband hasn't finished reading it yet. And my students are actually starting to read it next week because I'm teaching a class on object lessons where we pick out, you know, books from the series and then, you know, discuss them and analyze them and stuff. And so not even my students have had a chance to give me their feedback on this yet.
So then listeners to this interview, you guys can be right at the forefront of responses if you want.
I would love that.
Have a go. Read the book. Decide what you think about the game.
I have to tell you that when I had this idea, I was like, oh my gosh, this is genius. And so I don't know if anyone is going to actually agree with me or not. And, you know, periodically I thought, no, it's not genius. It's lame. It's so silly. But so, yeah, I'm curious to hear what you thought.
Well, I think you'll get a lot of interesting feedback, especially teaching it. I always find that students give us sometimes too blunt, but sometimes also really surprising feedback. So I'm sure you'll get a lot when you teach it, which leads me nicely on to my final question, which is quite simply, maybe slightly meanly, the book has just come out, but is there anything you might have your eye on to work on next we could get a sneak preview of?
Yeah, so, well, you're right about having to develop a thick skin in anticipation of my students' feedback, for sure. I mentioned that I pitched this idea of boat wreck at the first, and I still do want to pursue this idea. So I still have that kind of on the back burner as well. And then right now I'm really kind of immersed in this this tree ring project that I just started up called the Low Country Dendrochronology Project. And we have a kind of issue here in the northern part of coastal South Carolina, where the development, the real estate development, is really placing in jeopardy a lot of our wetlands and our ancient old growth forests. These are in particular longleaf pine forests that have been decimated since settler colonialism all across the Southeast. So we've only got about 3% of remaining forest cover of longleaf pine. And it is a fire-dependent ecosystem, which means that controlled burning has to happen periodically in order to maintain the ecosystem. And this is something that, you know, the ancestors of the tribal groups in this area now have been practicing again for generations. And so, you know, before it was outlawed. And so my project is basically trying to determine exactly how frequent those controlled burning intervals were that were practiced in pre-colonial times. So I'm looking at longleaf stumps and that survived the turpentine industry, and then also trying to match those up with records from shipwrecks that I'm sampling here in the area too. So it's quite an ambitious project, but one that has really urgent implications, as you know, they're trying to build a hospital across the street from a nature preserve. That's one of the last few holdouts for longleaf pine ecosystems that have rare birds and Venus flytraps and other carnivorous plants. And so if the hospital is built across the street, then of course they won't be able to practice controlled burning there anymore, for obvious reasons of smoke inhalation. That forest will, that whole ecosystem will again be enormously threatened. So that's the project that I'm working on right now. And unfortunately, I think boat wreck is going to have to wait until, I don't know, a rainy month or something. But
well, both of them sound like very fascinating projects. So thank you for sharing them with us. And while you are off working on them, of course, listeners can read the book we've mainly been discussing, again, titled Mushroom, part of the Objects Lesson series from Bloomsbury. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda.